Bonjour, bonsoir, dear friends. Happy hour. This is JCB Live. I'm so excited to be with you tonight, live from the beautiful town of Yonville. So we have an incredible guest. Ladies, hold yourself to your seat, to your bar, to your chair, to your table. He is irresistible. I promise we'll share his number if you behave well. He is an incredible writer. He's written 4 books. He has an unbelievable podcast that you must listen to. And very importantly, he writes for so many great magazines. He knows wine, spirits. He knows it all. His surname is The Imbiber. Isn't it a great name? His name is D-Square Dan Dunn. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the fantastic Dan Dunn. And Dan, look at that. All right. The sex symbol of the wine and spirits business.
That's me, man.
I can tell.
How's it going?
How are you?
It's good to see you. It's been a while.
Great to see you. Well, cheers. Maybe you want to have...
Okay. I'm going to do...
Whichever you want.
I got the red bubbles.
Absolutely.
So put that in there.
You write so well, Playboy, JQ, USA Today, all of those. So cheers to your amazing career as a writer.
Thank you.
And wine taster.
I appreciate that intro. Where are you hanging out there, man? It looks pretty cool.
Thank you. Well, this is our JCB wine bar in Yonville, the place someone like you needs to hang out more often.
I'm ready, man. I'm getting bored down here in LA. A road trip might be in order.
Well, we welcome you anytime and we'll come down and see you. So, Dan, what a surprise having a red sparkling. What do you think of it?
It's fantastic. I was going to say Lambrusco. I know this is not Lambrusco, but it's a red sparkling. I have written about red bubbly numerous times. I've not had this, the first time I'm having this, and it's fantastic. It's amazing. This makes me want to, anytime I have red bubbles, I want to get in trouble. You know?
And I know you've never gotten in trouble, right?
No. That was my twin brother.
Well, Dan, what is the most exciting trouble you could share?
Oh, man.
I know there's so many going through your head right now, but I think-
Well, how much time you got? First of all, let me say this too, by the way, not only do I have the bubbles, I also made a gin and tonic with the JCB gin. So.
Well, thank you so much. You're way in advance. I mean, you're kind of the king of cocktail making. So you're going to have to tell us, you know what I'm going to do for the fun of it? And I'd love for you to give me your opinion on that because you're wine and cocktail critique and you have an amazing palate, is to put a little gin in the French kiss. And
okay.
Add a little more French kiss.
Let's try that.
Let's try that, and then...
It's a hearty bottle. Bottle has soul.
Imbiber himself. I'm going to add, which I never do normally with wine, but this is kind of a cocktail. A little ice cube. What about this? Boom. Blending both together.
Oh, yeah. That's delicious.
Wow. That works well for me. So, Dan, you didn't want to answer the question. What we say as a new word is you pivoted very nicely on the left, on the right. But you're still going to answer that question I ask you.
Well, I've never been convicted. Let's just put it that way. You know, as I've gotten older, I've mellowed out a little bit more. But certainly, you know, when I used to live in Aspen, I think we talked about this, and I worked with Dr. Hunter S. Thompson.
Yes.
So as you can imagine, there was a lot of trouble there when you know, Dr. Gonzo himself, a lot of firing of guns and substances that might not be legal, while firing guns. So Hunter's neighbor across the street, so Hunter lived outside of Aspen in a place called Woody Creek.
Yep.
And his neighbor across the road was John Oates from Hall & Oates. And so John and I became friends. And then I remember years later, you know, a couple of years after I met John, became friends. I was at Hunter's one night. I don't know, must have been 4 in the morning. And we decided to go outside and blow up a keg with a 357 Magnum.
Ooh, so my
beer keg. And he gave me the gun and he put the keg and he said, shoot it. And I remember he was screaming, and Hunter had this very unique, and he's like, ah, you son of a bitch, ah, and yelling at me. And again, I may have been under the influence of some things, and I took this gun and I, boom, and I shot it, and it didn't blow the keg up. In fact, the bullet like ricocheted off the keg. The stupidest thing you could have done. I mean, this thing could have shot off and hit somebody. But anyway, the next day I got a phone call from John Oates, and he said, can you please not do that anymore? And I was like, well, you got a famous rock star calling you, telling you you're going too hard. You're going too hard. So,
well, I like how you position your thumb. You really know the drill and how to.
Yeah, you're going to get that. It's got a kick to it, 357 Magnum. So.
Hey, I have a few toys here.
Oh, wow.
I knew we were going to talk about guns. But we have a series of AK-47. If you want bubbles, you just go down and I serve you bubbles.
Look at that thing. That's amazing.
It's pretty cool, huh?
I want one of those.
Absolutely. So tell us about how is it to become such a great writer? How did you get that into your blood? Maybe, or how did you discover you had such a great talent as writing? Because you've written over 4 books.
Thank you.
Magazine, newspapers, you're everywhere.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, I mean, it's sort of the classic story, I guess, if you would get comedians and people that are funny and artists, you know, my childhood was not ideal. And my reaction to that I used to write little fantasy books. You know, I found these years ago in an old box. So I would have notepads and I would write these fantasy stories as a child. And, cool. You know, and the hero, there was a recurring theme in these stories. It would be, you know, there was a young hero who was set upon and having a hard time, but he would rally his super friends and they would defeat the evil and he would survive and he'd get out. And, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but obviously you don't have to be a psychologist to know what was going on there. You know, that was my way of projecting myself into a different and better life.
Yeah.
So writing became a real escape for me at a young age. It became like a friend almost, you know. When I was writing stories or I was reading books, I could escape. I could go anywhere. I could be anything. I could, and you know, that kind of carried over into some of my adult writing. People say, what did that really happen? Yeah, kind of. But writing became a thing that I did to feel normal. And then as I got into high school and I started writing for the paper at school, and I knew I had people would tell me, so I had an ability to do that. College, the same thing. But really, it was Aspen that changed my life. I grew up poor in Philly. We were poor. You know, I lived on top of a pasta shop with my mom, who was a hairdresser, and we were on, you know, we'd go to welfare. It was rough. So yeah. I never heard of Aspen. Never heard of it. I didn't know anybody that had ever been there, nothing. And I left Philly and I moved to Miami to live with an ex-girlfriend. And I was like, I'm going to write a book. And she was a nurse and I was 23 or 4. And I was in Miami for 19 days. And I realized this isn't working. And so I had a family friend that lived in Colorado, and I drove there. I'd never been to Colorado. I'd never seen it. Blew my mind. The first time I saw the Rockies, it took my breath away, you know. And I had some cousins that I didn't know very well growing up as well. And you're like, by the way, you're probably sitting there, Jean-Charles, going, I never knew this was going to be this fucking sad. This sad.
I think it's a great story. So I love it. On the opposite.
My dad said.
Inspirational.
Yeah. My dad said, why don't you go see your cousins, Dennis and Mike, who are around my age. Yeah. They had just moved to Aspen to be ski bums, you know? So I said, all right. And I drove over to the hill. I was on the other side of the mountains to Aspen. And I remember pulling in. It was January of 1993. It had just snowed. It was unbelievable. It was like the Chamber of Commerce couldn't have drawn up a better day, you know? And I got there and I thought, well, this is pretty nice. And I proceeded to have one of the best weekends of my life. And my cousins are like, why don't you stay? You can sleep on our couch. And that's what I did. And then I kept staying and staying. And my cousin's girlfriend at the time said, she read some stuff that I'd written in college. And she said, she was working for the Aspen Daily News, little newspaper. And she said, why don't you come meet my editor? Maybe he'd give you a job. And I met him and I gave him some stuff. And he said, you're a good writer. I don't have any money, but I could give you a column for free. I'm not getting paid anything. And I said, oh, all right, yeah, I'll do that. Sure. And I started writing a once a week column. And then one day I was in the bank cashing a check. And I had like five jobs. I worked on the mountain. I worked at a pizza place. I worked at the, you know, and I was cashing the check. And the girl behind the counter said, and I say girl because she must probably was 21. I was 23 or 4. And she said, are you Dan Dunn from the newspaper? And I went, and it blew me away. I was like, that was the, and I went, yeah. And she turned to the woman and she says, this is the guy from the paper that we love. So funny. And that Jean-Charles, that was the moment that I went, maybe I could do this, man. And I called my mom. I said, mom, some girl, I don't know her, said she knew who I was.
That's so
and,
cool.
And my mom was like, yeah, when don't you get a job? All right. When are you going to get a real job? You know? And I'm like, no, this is it. And then I ran for mayor of Aspen.
No.
Yes, I was 24 years
Why
old. Not? I ran for
the
mayor.
Yes. Yeah. Big.
And that's how I met Hunter.
Clint Eastwood of Aspen.
What's that?
I was saying the Clint Eastwood of Aspen, you know. From
yes, Florida. That was me. Yeah. And so that's how I met Hunter S. Thompson. He was impressed by that, and he called me up, and we became friends. And he really helped, you know, for as unstable as Hunter was. He was one of the greatest American writers of the 20th century, and he really helped steer me. And when I say helped, I mean, Hunter was not a naturally warm and fuzzy person. It was a lot of tough love, but it worked. It was effective. He would say, you're lazy. Stop being so lazy. And I think later on, after he died, we got invited to a screening. Alex Gibney, the Academy Award winning documentarian, did a movie called Gonzo about Hunter. And they invited some
of that one too.
Yeah. They invited some of his closest friends to come up to the premiere in San Francisco. We did that. And Hunter was already dead at that point. And Hunter's long, long, long time assistant, Deborah, pulled me aside and she said, you know, Hunter really choked up a little bit. Hunter really loved you. And I know he was really hard on you. And she explained to me that she thinks the reason he was because I was young. And I think Hunter was definitely lamenting his lost youth. You know, he didn't want to be old, killed himself, you know. So, I think she said he saw in you, here you are, this young guy, you got all this talent. You're screwing off. You're just.
So how did you go? How did you go from there to becoming such an amazing writer in all those magazines and newspapers, from GQ to Playboy magazine to USA Today? I mean, the list is endless.
Well, I could have stayed in Aspen. I was loving my life there. It's extremely comfortable. It's one of the most beautiful you've been, I'm sure. And
yep,
it's gorgeous. And I had a great group of friends and I loved my life there. But I also recognized, and so this would have been 1997, and I'd been there almost 5 years at this point. And I recognized that there are downsides to that lifestyle in Aspen. You know, as I wrote in my first book, the ATM machines spit out rolled up 20s. You know, there's a bill, you know, there's a bill to pay for that lifestyle, you know, and I could see it in some other people. I could see it in Hunter. I could see the effect that it was having on people. And then one day I got this is kind of a crazy story. I wrote a column about, it was so dumb, and it was a very bad winter. There was not a lot of snow. The tourists were on edge. And I wrote this really popular column, and I wrote a service guide, how to deal with tourists that were unhappy. I said, you never directly confront them, but if they're yelling at you and they're being assholes to you at the restaurant, you can always defile their food in the back before you bring it out, right? As a joke. And the Chamber of Commerce went crazy and like organized a boycott against the paper. And it got, I kid you not, this is how nuts it got. The New York Times did a front page story and it said the war in Aspen. And it was all about this stupid column that I wrote. So I got a phone call in the middle of all this from Newsday in New York, you know, and they said, hey, would you write about this experience for us, about what happened? And I did. And it was a very funny piece. And there was an editor from the Tribune in Arizona happened to be vacationing in New York City. He read this piece. They had a photo of me. I looked like a total punk. I had a ski cap on, sunglasses. I was like this, you know, like, yeah, you know. And he kept it.
Not just one hand, but you use both hands. You might as well.
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. It was like, so this is, you know, pre-internet. So he kept, not pre-internet, but it wasn't like you could just Google me. So he kept this column. He ripped it out of the paper and he kept it. So about a year and a half later, the Tribune was in Phoenix, Arizona, was launching a new weekly to compete with the New Times. And they said, we need a young voice, a columnist, somebody with attitude and blah, blah. And they're going around, and this guy, Phil Boas, remembered that thing, and he went and got it, and he's like, what about this guy, right? And that's how it happened. I got a phone call out of the blue from Arizona, and they said, can we fly you down here to talk about this job? And I went, yeah, sure. I'd never been flown anywhere, you know? And not only that, they flew me first class, never flown first class. I was such a rube, Jean-Charles, I really was. So I went down there, and it's pretty funny because, again, growing up the way I did, I didn't know anything about money and I didn't know the value. I didn't know any of it. So they said, I thought I was going for an interview, but I had the job, you know, and they said, what's it going to take to get you down here? So I didn't want to leave Aspen. So I said, I thought to myself, I'll throw out a crazy number that they'll never say yes to. So ready? This is 1997. Which is a long time ago.
Journalism, which is amazing, because it typically doesn't pay that well, right?
Well, but I can tell you this. So this is still, Phoenix is a big city, and, you know, so I said, they go, what is it going to take? And I went, $50,000. And I think
you put your hand like this.
$50,000. So I think they were all kicking themselves under the table, because I definitely undersold myself, you know, and they're like, we could do that, $50,000. And I'm like, and my own computer. And they're like, okay. And can you like split the money that it's going to cost me to move down here? And they're like, we'll pay the whole thing to move you down. And I'm like, so I was faced with a choice, and I got back to Aspen, and there was just this moment that I'm sure anybody who's ever done anything in their life meaningful has had that moment when they go, I can stay here, I can stay comfortable, I can keep doing this thing that I love doing and I feel happy, or I can take that leap. And it was a leap. I didn't know anybody in Arizona. That was the first time I'd ever been there. I didn't know anything about it. I'd never been a columnist at a big city newspaper. I didn't know if I could do it. Failure never scared me that much, but I still didn't know that I could do it. And I said, yeah, screw it. I'm leaving. And I left.
Yeah. And you did it.
And I went, yeah. And I went down there and I did really well, won a couple awards. And then I thought, well, any club that's going to have me, I don't want to be a part of it. So I left and I moved to Hollywood or California, LA.
Of course. And you have the Hollywood face too. Besides the brain to write and everything else, you have the look. So what happened?
Back in the day. Yeah. No, I'm friends with Steven Soderbergh, the director. And the first time I met him a couple years ago, he kept saying, we'd been drinking, and he said, we were in San Francisco, and he said, man, you look like Colin Farrell. And he goes, I actually was trying to cast Colin Farrell in this movie I'm doing. Maybe I'll get you a lot cheaper, and you can be the stand-in for Colin Farrell. Didn't happen. I didn't get the role.
I'm going to give him a call to make sure that he gives you a second chance.
Get me in.
There's always a chance. So yes. Now, after all those amazing experiences, what is actually the favorite article you wrote and the favorite topics you like to write about?
Well, I in terms of art, I mean, the favorite thing I've written is my book, my most recent book, American Wino.
Which I have right here. Look at
there
this.
It is. Yes.
Dear friends, one of the most amazing book ever. We're going to talk about this one because I want to make sure everybody buys it.
Well, that book is a very personal book to me because, my brother died, my younger brother, and that book ended up being sort of the, he passed away. It's so crazy to think this, it's been 10 years. And then years later, I ended up taking this trip around the United States, ostensibly to become the leading expert on wine in America. One of the very first places I went on that trip was Raymond.
Thank you.
Up there, yeah. And I remember being blown away by that place because it's to this day still it probably is the single most unique winery that I've ever been to.
Well, and it fits your style. It fits your personality.
I have this great photo that I should send you, and I'm going to get it made I'm going to get it blown up that I took. I don't know if you still have the hands that are holding the mannequin hands that are holding. So I took a long shot of that. And then I have another one of there was a mannequin hanging upside down from a trampoline trapeze. So I loved it. I just loved that spot and the memories of that, of being there. You guys there had been a big party that night and they invited me to that party. And man, it was fantastic. So
well, that's when I got to see you the first time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's but so what I know, I drove.
What is amazing, Dan, forgive me to interrupt. Yeah. You have this vision, and that's why I adore this book, is you had the vision that you wanted to cross every state of the United States, write about every wine there is to offer in this amazing country. So what was your process? How did you do this? I mean, this is amazing.
Well, again, how the book came about was when Brian died, when my brother died, he drowned a mile from here in the Pacific Ocean on the 4th of July of 2010. Plane home from Pennsylvania, which is where we're from, Philadelphia. On the plane ride home, I met a woman on the plane. I wasn't trying to meet a woman on the plane. Obviously, I was in a depression, but I did. And we ended up together for about 3.5, almost 4 years.
Wow.
And when that relationship ended, and I just finished writing a book, this one, hold on. I just finished writing this, Always Sunny in Philadelphia book, the TV show. So I ghost wrote this book as the characters on the show.
This is great. Yeah.
So after that, I finished the book and the relationship ended and I was at a crossroads in my life and I was at my house. I was living in Marina Del Rey at the time and I was drinking wine and had music blasting, and I was in my underwear dancing around the place.
And I think you're wearing your short tonight.
I realized
you just in your underwear, you may want to do a striptease. I'm sure everybody will be thrilled.
So I had this idea, and again, you just never know. I think any artist would say this, is you collect things, right?
Yep.
But where, I don't know what other people's process is, but the real beauty for me of creating something is most times I don't know where it's coming from. It just comes. And in this particular case, I was there, I was drinking wine, and I thought, what am I gonna do? And then I thought, I'll just have more wine. And I have more wine, I'm getting drunk, and then I thought, I'm gonna have
many of us have been in that situation.
Yes, yes. So I thought, I'm gonna have all the wine in America. And I, fortunately, even though I was very buzzed, I wrote down on a notepad, all the wine in America, that's it. The next day I see that on the notepad and I Googled wine in America. And that's when I discovered that wine is made in every state in the United States. And I had no idea. And that's where the germ of the idea was right there. I knew I needed to, because I'd been in that relationship for 4 years, it kind of, like I hit the pause button on my grief, okay? And now she was gone, the book was done, I was all by myself, and I suddenly felt this tremendous weight of my brother's death. And I knew I needed to get out. I needed to clear my head, and that's where the idea was. I didn't care about at the time, I didn't care about going all over America. I just needed to get out. And so I pitched my editor the book. She said, I like it, but there needs to be an end to it. And I thought about it for a few days and I called her back and I said, all right, how about this? The goal, or there needs to be a goal. There needs to be stakes. Of course, there needs to be an end. There needs to be stakes. So I said, all right, how about this? At the end of my journey around the country, I'll give a seminar at a Shishi wine festival as the leading expert on American wine. So if I don't do it, then I'll fail miserably. And she said, I love it. She said, what's the festival? And I said, Pebble Beach Food and Wine. And she said, oh, great. Are they into it? And I said, of course they are. I never asked them, right? I said, yes, they're into it, way into it.
I'm surprised you have the guts to imagine that they could say yes.
And I knew they would, and he did, Dave. So Dave Bernal, he said yes. And that's what happened, man. And then I got in that car and I started. So I went up the coast and I started in with you guys. I started Napa, Sonoma. The very first stop on the tour was at Jordan. You know those guys at Jordan. Then I went over to Napa and then I went up through Oregon and Washington State. So I'm loving life, right? I'm going, this is incredible. You know, the Willamette Valley and all these places that have these. And I'm like, this is amazing. And then I went to Big Sky Country, which is some of the most beautiful place in the world. But the wine dropped off.
But
the
wine's
in Montana.
A qualifying question here. You know, you've been a writer on all kinds of topics, writing a newspaper, a magazine, writing about Hollywood, writing about different topics. How did it happen that you wanted to write about wine? I know you've been an expert on wine and spirits for a while, but...
Well, I didn't know wine that well. That's why, that's where it came. That was the challenge in my mind, was I'm going to learn more. But again, I didn't know what the book was. And ultimately the book's not, it's not a wine book. It's a memoir. Philadelphia Inquirer described the book as Eat, Pray, Love meets Sideways while on the road. And that was it. I mean, ultimately the book, I didn't know what it was going to be. I can tell you that it seems like another lifetime ago. So this was in 2014 that I made the trip. I left in early September and I didn't come home till Christmas and I was by myself. And I got to tell you, you think about how polarized the United States is now. So back then, I was in a lot of places, like I said, Montana, Nebraska, Louisiana, where I probably didn't agree with anybody. The people I was meeting, politically, we probably didn't agree on much, right? But the beauty of that trip was the through line was wine.
Yeah.
Wine was the unifying thing there. And that's what we talked about. And that's what brought us together. And I met, and I got to tell you, you know, I mean, you make wine in some of the most beautiful places in the world, in France and here. But what was really, really so encouraging to me and was beautiful was that, yeah, I'll give you an example. I was in a place in Western Wyoming.
Yeah.
Okay. A little winery there, and it'll come to me in a second, the name of the place. So it was a family of fifth generation farmers. They've been there forever and they're going to lose their farm because, you know, farming in this country has gone huge conglomerates and there's family farms aren't going to make it. So the grandson decides I'm going to go get my, I'm going to learn how to make wine.
Wow.
So he went to the University of Minnesota, learned how to, and we're going to convert our family farm into vineyards. Okay. And he did it. So, and I mean, it's not Raymond. Okay. When I pulled up to this place, and boy, I wish the name, it'll come to me, but I pulled up and it was just dirt and it's just flat. And there's a trailer, like a double wide. Okay. That's the winery. That's the wine shop and everything. So, but there's a couple of pickup trucks. I'm not kidding you. Some horses tied up. And I went in there. It was a Friday afternoon. And there were a couple of guys. There were some real life old cowboys hunkered up at this bar.
I could visualize it.
Drinking wine. And it really like brought a tear to my eye because I was like, this is incredible. These guys would never have had wine in their life if this guy wasn't making it, right? And it to me, it was such a testament to stick-to-itiveness, to resilience, to going, I am not going to lose my farm. And so to go around the country and see all of these people tied together by this one thing, this was so, I went to West Texas, right?
Yeah.
All cotton farms. The government got rid of the cotton farm subsidies. Those farmers couldn't tear up the cotton fields quick enough to plant vineyards. And guess what? They make great Spanish varietals, the Italian varietals. They're doing a really good job with this in Texas. And I'm out there. I had a meet. It's in the book. There's a whole part in there in the book where I sit down with these farmers. It's called the Barnery. It was in Plains, Texas. It's in the middle of nowhere, right?
That's right.
And they were so warm, so welcoming, and they were so damn enthusiastic, man, about the future because of wine. And it, you know, and it was amazing. And I can tell you this.
That's amazing. That's an amazing book. And now, what inspires you as well with spirits? Because you really are an amazing spirit reviewer and cocktail maker and mixologist and all the above. You have an incredible palate. So tell us as well the parallel you have with wine and spirits.
Well, spirits have been the thing I've been doing longer. The very first thing I ever did was in 2000. I got a gig going to Scotland to tour Scottish distillery. And I didn't know anything then, but that was the beginning of it. And if you've ever been, I'm sure you've been to Scotland, right? And distilleries, and it's magical. It really is. And that lit the fire for me. So I would certainly say my knowledge about alcohol or spirits as opposed to wine, wine is alcohol, spirits as opposed to wine is greater. You know, I just years of doing it, man. And I get a lot of it. And I, you know, I've been to hundreds and hundreds of distilleries. And, you know, sometimes you go to these things, you go on these trips and blah, blah, blah. It's, fermentation, distillation, both. But you know what? It all sinks in. And then you start picking up the little nuances and you go, oh, okay. Now I know how that barrel is influencing the flavor as, you know, as this. Now I know how that mash bill is influencing the flavor versus this.
So
how
now, many distillations? Big question to you in front of everyone tonight. Let's do a little description of the gin that you have. We've tried the
French. Of your gin.
Yes. I want you to tell me about it because We selected it for you, and our good friend Jen was really insistent because you're the best man between wine and spirits. So let's try Pure, the JCB's gin, because you know, that's
what a bottle.
Thank you.
By the way, this is very important. The packaging is such a big deal. You know, you see this bottle, the first thing it says to me, and I think it says to a lot of consumers, is they give a shit, right? You do. You don't go to these lengths on the packaging if you don't give a shit. Like, I know that. If I see a bottle like this, if I see a bottle that, I mean, this is a gorgeous, beautifully constructed packaging. I know that whoever made this gin did not go to all this trouble to put Rock Gut gin in here. Okay. So I know that. So that's very important. And then, so that would be the
pointing that out.
If I was evaluating something, the very first thing I would evaluate is the package is great. Okay. And then, you know, you're going to put it in here. And so, you know, as I always say, when I'm nosing a spirit, you don't want to ram your nose in there. I'm telling you things you already know, but you don't want to ram your nose in here like you would with wine, because it'll burn your nostrils out. But so I'm breathing this in, okay? I got my mouth open when I do this, so I'm, you know.
So explain why you keep your mouth open, because I think that's a very important detail on spirits.
For spirits, for sure. You don't need to do that for wine, but with spirits, with wine, I'm going to, you know, here at wine, I'm like, you know, oh yeah, bring it. You do that with an 80 proof spirit. What's the proof on this gin?
Exactly that, 85.
Okay, yeah. So you're going to burn out your nostrils. So what you want to do is you want to keep your mouth open slightly, you know, and then you're just breathing the whole thing in, you know, like it's like you walked out into nature and you just went, yeah. So, and by the way, when I nose this, that's what I feel like I walked out into nature, because it's very floral. It's an extremely floral gin, you know, more so than, you know, I'm doing a martini segment, on the Adam Carolla show soon. And so I've had some gins and I've been nosing gins. This one is one of the most floral gins that I love on the nose.
That as a compliment, because I love
it. Yeah, no, but you're also getting that like citrus zest to it that I think, and what that does to me, when I smell that, my mouth starts to water. Cause I know in, especially in certain cocktails, like this was a gin and tonic, which is simple, but a very floral, zesty, citrusy gin is so good in a gin and tonic. So I know, yo. So then, yeah, and then what I usually do when I take a sip of something like this is I'll do a little, just a tiny bit to coat my palate.
I'm doing it with you.
Because I was drinking the bubbly. So now I've coated my palate with that gin, and now I'm ready to go in for the sip where I'm gonna, you know.
Show me the serious sip. Tell me the big statement, because it's the association of we make wine and then we distill Chardonnay and Pinot from Burgundy. So we wanted you to see it, because it's actually the blend conceptually and intellectually of wine being distilled. As you have wine and spirits, which is unusual, which I love within you, this is actually the best crossover.
It's so... You know, you'll hear sometimes when people talk about tasting notes, they'll say the mid palate.
Yeah.
What that is when I'm getting, the first thing I'm getting here is right here. It's hitting me right here. And it's everything that the nose promised, the gin's delivering. Okay. I'm getting that citrus. I'm getting that floral. I'm, you know, the juniper's there.
Yeah.
But what I do, this is not an overpowering juniper gin, right? The juniper's right there, but it's delicate.
Subtle.
And I like that. I there are certain gins, I won't name them, but you know, that are very juniper forward.
That's right.
Some people love that. That's not my personal preference. Okay. You know, like gin's dirty secret, of course, is it's the world's first flavored vodka, you know? And so I want my gin to be, I appreciate subtlety in gin, again, versus a gin that's going to have that juniper really up front that can overpower a cocktail, certainly. And This one is, the other thing about this is the mouthfeel on this. Again, anybody watching out there, you might be like, oh, these bullshit terms. They're not bullshit terms. They really aren't. It's, and I used to think that, so the mouthfeel, because this is the thing. When I'm evaluating stuff, and I don't like to over-evaluate things, but what I will say this is, it all matters, okay? You might not know it at the time when you're experiencing it, but the mouthfeel matters to you. The average drinker isn't going to go, oh, that's a really silky mouthfeel. That's really, you know, but the more you do it and the more stuff you try, you start to go, oh yeah, like that gin's hard. Like there's spirits that are hard. And I don't just mean because they have a lot of out, but it's just like, you know, that thing where it's like, and that's not necessarily bad all the time. But then there are the ones that are just very, it's like you laid in bed and you pulled your favorite blanket over you, and it's just very comfortable and easy. And that's what this gin is to me. It's very comfortable and easy. And it's obviously a gin that has been lovingly crafted. And I say that word crafted because that's what this is. It's a craft to make great alcohol.
And I love the fact that you said floral. And, you know, we have over 48 different plants, you know, composed within this.
Of the botanicals that you're using, you mean?
That's right. It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. So now, Dan, we have a few more minutes.
Okay.
And a lot of friends asking a lot of questions about you, which is great. You're an amazing inspiration, but what inspires you today?
What inspires me today? Well, that's
because you gave us so many great clues about inspirational moment in your life, epiphany moment. You've given so many great advice in many ways because your life story is incredible. And I'm so admirative from where you started to where you are today, to, you know, the unbelievable influencer you've become in journalism, in writing, in wine, in spirits, in food. What drives you today to continue to do what you do and more?
I mean, obviously we're living in a very difficult time, you know, in terms of not knowing when we're gonna get out of this pandemic and all that. I mean, that's so, these days, what I'm drawing inspiration from, I would say this, I've gotten to know myself a lot better because I'm with myself most of the time. I'm alone a lot.
I think there's a lot of ladies who send you a lot of message. And
yeah,
I know,
you know, well, I was it. I, you know, I got single.
I doubt you're alone that long.
No. If anybody's out there, here I am at the Imbiber. I think that what's driving me these days is the idea that we're going to come out of the other side of this. I feel like this is the universe's way of saying, at least certainly here in America, you know, like maybe we're on the wrong path a little bit here. And I think certainly nature, I think, is getting a big rebound here from what's going on. There's not as many, you know, you're seeing that all over the place. And because people just aren't out driving, they're not in planes, we're not the carbon imprint, footprint, all that. But I think this was the universe's way of going, let's show you what life can be if you don't value it and you don't take care of it. And if you don't, you know, and so what inspires me now is the idea that we're going to come out the other side of this.
Yes.
With a much greater appreciation. I know, like, just the idea, everything that we took for granted, that I could come see you at the winery, that we could meet up and hang out with John Legend and drink wine and have food, all of these things that we took for granted. And I'm not saying I wasn't grateful for those things, but it was always going to be there, wasn't it? Like, of course, yes. I'd go here. And when it's taken away, and it's been taken away in such a dramatic fashion, I'll tell you what, man, I am never going to have a nice meal or be at a winery again and not think to myself, Jesus Christ, am I lucky to be here right now? Well said. You know? Yeah.
And Dan, thank you for saying that, because what you're really discussing is a life lesson that we should be appreciative, we should be grateful, and we should enjoy the present time as well. Talking about this, as I'm going to ask you about your passion, because I know you have a lot. And you've been a very passionate speaker. You're an amazing writer, but you're a great speaker, which is not always the case. I want you to go back to time. And as you have those wise words of history within what you just explained, as far as appreciating the time and the present time and so forth, let's dive into this wine. And as you taste it, this is a cream cherry from Buena Vista. Dear friends, this is one of the most unusual wine we've recreated with the history of Buena Vista, which was drank a lot in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, a very big iconic wine for America, and still for the world of wine and spirits, because it's a big wine in Spain and all over the world. Give us a message to everyone as we taste this wine, describe the wine, and then give us your best message to the world.
Okay, so first off, I poured my gin into the glass that I was going to have the sherry in here. So can I just?
Absolutely, but I expect you to drink half of it. Well, if you're doing it, I might as well do the same.
This is a classy show we're doing here now.
It's actually much better out of the bottle. I mean, I was not thinking, drinking out of a crystal glass, I might as well toss it for the night.
Well, let me tell you this.
My friend of the evening.
This is not Harvey's Bristol Cream, okay? Let's just say that right now. I mean, you know, this is a delicious cream sherry. You know, cream sherry, generally an after-dinner drink. This is delicious. You said it about Buena Vista, one of the more iconic, I believe, like 1870.
1867.
Yeah, so geez.
Yeah, but that's okay. You forgive it.
So, you know, this is delicious. I love this. It's something that I would love to sip. If I were back in Aspen and I just got done skiing, a little après-ski action, some of this, right?
Yeah.
Maybe even take a little, put this in my coffee a little bit, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Why not?
But I got to say, it's all fantastic. I mean, everything you do is great. You know that. This red bubbly is some of the best I've had.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah, I mean,
Miller, we one of the only wine in France to ever do it. It's based from Gamay, you know, from the Beaujolais region.
Of course.
It's only 8% or less than 8% alcohol. So all that comes with it. I think it's a fantastic drink as well. But Dan, give us your word of wisdom, because you've had an incredible life. You've been doing so many phenomenal things. We've been spending almost an hour together, which was so fantastic. Give a big message to the world that really comes from the imbiber, which is your name, as well as Dan Dunn.
I would say, don't sweat the petty things.
Yeah.
And don't pet the sweaty things. All right, I stole that. That's George Carlin.
God, I need my thesaurus for translation here. Remember, I'm a Frenchman.
Yes. My own personal words of wisdom would be along the lines of what we talked about earlier, which is, you know, and I appreciate what you have. And I think most people right now are probably acutely aware of that now, of what they have and who they can trust and who, you know, the people that you have, because now we've been crammed in that together with them for 5 months. So appreciate what you have and keep your head up and look forward to because we're going to get through this crap that we're going through. And I mean, and it, you know, the universe will throw stuff at you. I mean, not only do we have COVID, I know where you're at right now. There's fires raging.
It's just a little hot right now.
Yeah, you know, you got wildfires, you got pandemics, you got all these things, but the human spirit's going to prevail, man. And we're going to make it through this, and we're going to make it through it stronger. I'm going to come up there. I'm going to hang out with you in Napa.
And I cannot wait. And we want to see your fifth book, not just The American Wino. You have three others. So yes. We'll post and list every one of them because we want everybody to read you, feel you, sense you. I know everybody's going to go on your podcast. So remind us, everyone, your podcast name.
It's called What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. The latest episode right now is Dan Aykroyd, the great Dan Aykroyd, legendary comedian. Dan Aykroyd's on. We've got Jason Aldean coming up, the country superstar. We got Maynard James Keenan, winemaker / lead singer of Tool in a Perfect Circle, coming on the show. Kurt Russell's been on the show. Steven Soderbergh, Aisha Tyler, Matthew McConaughey has been on my show. We got to get you on my show, man. I did yours. You ready to do mine now?
I'm ready anytime.
I'm holding you to that. I'm holding you to that, man.
We'll have to bring a few bottles of wine if it's okay.
Absolutely. I might have to drive up the coast and do that. And we could do it social distancing, but yeah.
Oh, for sure.
I might have to come up, man. That'd be fantastic.
Well, congratulations for all what you do, Dan. Thank you for being with us tonight. It was amazing. It was fabulous. Everybody got to know you and me even more. There's some sides I did not know. And you are extraordinary. Keep being who you are. And this is, I think, the recipe of success.
Well, hey, I want to say thank you, man, because, you know, you have that that quality about you. You know, I don't know you well, but we've met a few times, and where you, it's your enthusiasm for life, and you're, you know, it's infectious. You know, every time I've been around you, you project positivity. So when I was asked to come on and do this, of course I jumped at it because I feel better now than I did when I started the show.
Thank you.
And that's the effect you have on people. So
well, and you have the same, and you're amazingly inspirational. So Dan, to friendship, to many more times together in person again. And we cannot wait to be on your show, of course. And we cannot wait to see you and keep the great work. So excited. I'm going gin now.
Cannonball.